This is Mark Strassman, reporter with Etopia Media Environment and Energy News Network. We're about to speak to Mark Z. Jacobson, who's an associate professor of civil and environmental engineering at Stanford University. Welcome to Etopia Media Environment and Energy News Network.
Thank you, Mark.
Could you tell us, to start with, when the Department of Civil Engineering became the Department of Civil and Environmental Engineering, and what prompted that change?
The department became the Civil and Environmental Engineering about 5 to 7 years ago. And it was due to the fact that the department had a big component of environmental engineering, which was mostly groundwater pollution, and it used to be called sanitation engineering. And the environmental engineering component grew and started to include atmospheric sciences in the early 90s. But about 5 to 7 years ago, there was a sufficient number of people in the department who were working on environmental engineering and atmospheric issues that the department decided to change to civil and environmental engineering.
This, of course, implicitly implies that the environment can be engineered at almost any scale, doesn't it?
Yes and no. I mean, most of the actual engineering is done at small scales, like aquifers and looking at groundwater remediation.
Right.
But in terms of the atmospheric component, a lot of it is studies of the atmosphere, and some of it can be considered engineering, although we're not necessarily looking at engineering methods of changing the atmosphere as opposed to studying the atmosphere and the science of it.
Okay, but eventually when global weather control happens, it'll be from the environmental engineering component at Stanford, we can assume.
Right. There is some engineering aspects in terms of analysis and looking at ways to improve the environment.
Or ways, for example, to restore the ozone layer with various massive constructions or such.
Yeah, but mostly in terms of, let's say, emission controls.
Right.
That's probably where most of the engineering would come. Of course, you can look at air pollution regulation or air pollution controls from, let's say, power plants or vehicles that would also fall under engineering as well.
Okay, say a little bit about your own training and the questions that you explore in your current research.
Okay, my PhD is in atmospheric sciences, and I've studied mostly air pollution and climate modeling, and I've developed and applied computer models to study air pollution, climate, and weather. I actually did my undergraduate degrees in civil engineering and economics, and did a master's degree in environmental engineering before doing a master's in atmospheric science and a PhD in atmospheric science.
Okay, now this is something that's sort of implicit background in what we're going to be talking about, but with the training that you have and the knowledge that you have, can you say whether the question of global climate change is still debatable among competent scientists, or whether it's known as a theory, of course, but it's a theory that's generally accepted as the facts.
Yeah, most scientists, I'd say almost all scientists who are trained in atmospheric sciences, believe that global warming is a well-known is a fact and not a theory, and the only questions are the magnitude of the anthropogenic, which means the human-influenced warming versus natural. But it's pretty well known that the from temperature data, for example, that temperature changes today in the last 10 years, or you can go back 20 years or last 50 years, the rate of change of temperature today is much greater from the in the observational record than during any time since the deglaciation from the last ice age.
So we can say it's statistically significant.
Yeah, it's very statistically significant and pretty obvious when you actually plot the temperature record.
And without plotting the temperature records, anecdotally, having been here in Los Angeles over the last week with mostly over 100 degree temperature in the San Fernando Valley, I can say that anecdotally it seems like something's happening.
Although you can't pinpoint individual
right.
weather events to global warming necessarily, you can look at the fact that the number of these events is increasing,
right.
and average temperatures are getting hotter. And so in conjunction with the other information you have, you can pretty much, that's additional evidence.
Okay, good. Now, with minor exceptions, all energy on, with vents in the middle of the ocean, with minor exceptions, all energy on Earth derives from solar energy. How does solar energy become wind energy, and how does wind energy become electrical energy through the use of wind turbines? Give us a brief synopsis of that process.
Well, solar energy causes heating and cooling mostly of the land surfaces.
Right.
And the ocean temperatures don't change so much, because ocean water can hold a lot of energy. You can add a lot of energy to ocean water before you can change its temperature.
Right.
So the variation of the ocean temperature is pretty small compared to the land temperature.
Okay.
And you can tell that just by going over onto the sand, and your feet are very hot during a sunny day, and then you can walk in the water and see that the temperature is pretty much the same in winter or summer.
Is that pretty much because it's the surface that absorbs the energy, whereas in the ocean, it's the entire bulk of the water?
It's really the properties of the soil versus the water.
Okay.
And there's a certain property called specific heat.
Right.
That's the main property. And certain types of soils can absorb sunlight to greater degrees than others. So that's why sand, in fact, heats up more than does clay soil.
Right.
And then clay with a lot of water in it doesn't heat up so much, because it has the water, which absorbs a lot of energy before changing temperature.
Okay, but as a general proposition, then the land heats and cools more rapidly than the oceans.
Exactly, and so when the land heats, air starts to rise, and that rising air causes a decrease. When the air rises, it usually spreads out horizontally. Then,
right,
and that decreases the total column of air, the total column of air. The weight of the air above a given point is called air pressure.
Right.
And so when you decrease the total column of the air, you decrease the air pressure.
Right.
And so then when the temperature is cold somewhere else, air sinks, because cold air sinks, hot air rises.
Right.
When the cold air sinks, then air horizontally goes over the region where the air is sinking to replace the air that is sinking.
Right.
So you build up the column of air, therefore increasing the pressure. So when you have cold air at the surface, you usually have high pressure.
Right.
And when you have warm air at the surface, you have low pressure. So so temperature changes change pressures. And whenever you have a difference in pressure between two regions, that's called a pressure gradient.
Right.
And the pressure gradient drives winds, because air then flows horizontally from where there's a lot of it, where the pressure is high, to where there's not very much.
So it's a little bit like osmosis then, at a biological level.
Exactly. It's just the process. Let's say you're in a room and you release a gas on one side of the room, that gas is going to spread out to the other side of the room.
Right.
Easily.
Okay. So essentially, this is where the wind comes from.
Exactly. So the wind is driven by pressure gradients, or differences in pressure between two places, and pressure gradients are driven by temperature gradients, and that's where differences in sunlight or shading, or different types of soil, can lead to different heating of the surface, and therefore different pressures, and then therefore different wind speeds.
So, along with the tilting of the Earth's axis, which affects the angle at which the solar energy is incident, it's the topography of the land that has a lot to do with the climate there.
Correct. Yeah, and especially if you have very mountainous terrain, if in the morning you might get shadows in some places, so it'll be cooler. And whereas on the mountain face that's facing the sun, the mountain face will heat up. And so like a valley might be cold and a mountain face might be warm. And so can also drive a wind.
So since the latitude of any particular place is constant and the topography is more or less constant, weather patterns in any particular place are likely to go through the same cycle every year and be characteristic of that place on an ongoing basis.
There's at a given latitude. Well, if you look globally, there are certain regions, like at 30 degrees north latitude and 30 degrees south latitude, you'll notice that almost all the deserts of the world are located. And that's because on a global scale, you have what's called a general circulation pattern, where air rises predominantly near the equator on average,
right,
because you get the most sunlight there.
Right.
And it rises and then it goes up about up to 18 kilometers, and which is where the stratosphere starts. And the stratosphere is a region where you have the ozone layer.
Right.
But at the stratosphere, the air spreads out horizontally and starts to go towards the poles from the equator in both directions.
Right.
Then, but as the air gets to about 30 degrees north and 30 degrees south, it starts to sink.
Right.
And when air sinks, it starts to compress and warm, and compressing and warming air evaporates the clouds. So as a result, at 30 degrees north and 30 degrees south, you don't have very many clouds, and you still have a lot of sunshine. And as a result, you get all the deserts.
That's very interesting. So essentially, the sun, as a heat pump, creates that flow from the equator in both directions, which then creates the deserts at the 30-degree latitudes.
Right. And at the same time, at the equator, since the air is rising, when air rises, it expands and cools. And when it cools, it cools sufficiently to the point where all the water vapor in the air condenses to form clouds and rain. So you have a lot of rain at the equator, and so this region is often called the doldrums,
right?
Because that was a region where, the pressure gradients were actually pretty light there, but it was always raining and depressing. So
right.
Sort of ships would also often become stalled there and down in the doldrums.
So when people are down in the doldrums, that's because their internal weather is like that weather.
All right.
All right. Now we're gonna come back to the differential location of better or more wind, but say something first about how well established the technology is for converting wind power to electric power, and what the general principles of doing that are.
Wind turbines have been around for a while. They started to be used significantly for energy starting in the 1970s. In California.
How do they differ in technology from what's been around much longer, windmills?
Windmills have been around for much longer, but they work on the same principle. Essentially, the wind blows a blade that rotates, and and the blade will then internally and. Now the turbines will generate electricity internally, and I don't want to be able to, not going to be able to explain that
right
here. But before, windmills were often used mechanically. When the blade was blowing when the wind was blowing the blade, then the turning would to turn a chain, for example, and the chain would create mechanical work,
right,
and maybe pull water or be used for some type of mechanical work rather than converting the mechanical energy into electrical energy.
Right. So, in fact, it was used to grind grain or to pump water out of the Zeder Zee in Holland or different uses like that.
Right, right. So, before kind of electricity.
Right, before electricity. But the use of wind power to do useful stuff has a long human tradition, though, before wind turbines.
Oh, yeah, yeah. I think it dates back to maybe 500 AD or
right.
even earlier.
Not to mention, of course, wind power is a source of energy for ships, which
right,
of course has an important historical component.
Oh yeah, yeah. The winds have winds have been well known, and also people have been trying to predict the winds for thousands of years. In fact, Aristotle was the first so-called meteorologist. He wrote a book called Meteorologica,
right,
in which he tried to describe how weather works and how winds form.
How good is he in contemporary terms?
Not many people have heard of his book.
Right.
Because he wasn't very good at his methodology. That he used a methodology which would, most of his theories were found out to be not correct.
He was a little better in the social sciences or closer, which may be a lack of tribute to the social sciences rigor, but there you go. So.
Right. But nevertheless, he still gave it a try and gave something to be improved upon later. Descartes wrote the next meteorological book, and it was a little better because he used a scientific method.
Right.
But subsequently, a lot of things improved after that.
Okay. So if you could just briefly say how it is that the motion of the wind transferred through the blades turns something, and that turning makes for the generation of electricity?
Correct. Yeah, correct. And then the electricity is passed through transmission lines, and the transmission lines then are, currently they go to, let's say, to a network, to a in our power station that then distributes electricity to individual homes.
Okay, now how efficient is that conversion compared to other types of energy conversions?
The efficiency, well, there are a lot of types of efficiencies
right.
involved. The most important one is how frequently the wind is blowing.
Right.
Turbines are rated by, or usually each turbine will have a rated power. So let's say a 1.5 megawatt turbine, that's 1,500 kilowatts.
That's pretty much a standard unit for a wind turbine?
Yeah, so that would be a pretty large turbine. It might be something that the hub height, which is the height at which the blade rotates,
right.
is about 80 meters
okay,
above the ground.
Again, that's kind of the standard hub height and capacity
of a modern
wind turbine.
Yeah, correct, of a modern large turbine.
So. Right. And people will have seen these at Altamont Pass or out in the Riverside County by Palm Springs and so on.
Yeah, although most of those turbines are actually smaller. They
okay.
might be 600 to 800 kilowatts.
Oh, okay. Where are some of the current biggest wind turbines?
Well, the 1.5 megawatts, you'll probably find several of them in Texas, many of them Texas, and in some of the Great Plains.
Okay.
Along the Oregon-Washington border, there's a new wind farm. It has some. I think there may be some in Palm Desert now, but they're more of the older ones.
Now, what's the trade-off between making them too big for the wind to push or too small not to leave any wind on the table, so to speak?
Actually, there's no disadvantage for going bigger and bigger. In fact, the 1.5 megawatts I was referring to are not the smallest ones. They're now turbines that are 4.5.
You mean not the biggest ones?
Yeah, they're not the biggest ones. There are turbines that are now 4.5 to 5.5 megawatts, and they're used mostly for offshore wind.
Right.
But it's actually the higher you go, the faster the wind is.
Okay.
And so there's an advantage of actually going taller and taller.
Right.
And also the bigger your turbine, or the greater the diameter of your blade.
Right.
The more kind of power you can generate from the wind, or energy you can generate from the wind.
Right.
So there's also the larger you go, there's a thing called economies of scale where the costs go down with larger and larger turbines.
The cost for constructing and installing and maintaining them, you're saying?
Well, per unit energy
right.
output.
Okay.
The costs go down with larger turbines.
And the fact is, if you build a big one and there's less wind some of the time than you thought there might be at the optimal time, the maximum or optimal times, you're still going to get something out of it. It doesn't need to reach a particular threshold in order to get going and do anything. Is that
well?
Is
there
that
is
right?
a low threshold, usually about 2 to 3 meters per second.
Right.
Before the turbine turns on. So sometimes you'll see turbines not doing anything.
Right.
That's usually because they're below the threshold.
Okay.
The power output at a given instant increases with what they call the cube of the wind speed.
Right.
So if I have a wind speed of, let's say, 10 meters per second, then the power output is proportional to 10 times 10 times 10 of the wind speed. And if I double that, then the power output would be 20 times 20 times 20. However, turbines actually have a upper limit, too, to how fast they can go before they don't generate more power. That's called the rated power. There's a danger of the turbine, if it goes too fast, of breaking up or because being damaged. But the limit for how fast the wind can be before the turbine breaks is pretty high. It's equivalent to a Category 4 or 5 hurricane, which is the highest, fastest hurricane you can
okay.
have.
Right. Now, Bob Dylan wrote a long time ago that you don't need a weatherman to know which way the wind blows. Does the way the wind blows in any particular place have any effect on the turbine, and can they be adjusted to face into the wind where you'd expect that they'd have the most efficiency, or do they have to be stuck where they in the attitude that they're in, and they have to take or leave the wind then?
The new turbines today actually rotate their angle towards the wind. There's some of the new ones today. Some of the older ones and some of the existing new ones are fixed in place.
Right.
So they become less efficient, let's say, if the wind is coming from the side.
Right.
Although they can still blow. I mean, they can still move around.
Right.
But the new technology is that turbines actually rotate their, the blades actually rotate.
And is that essentially handled by electronic sensors and actuators in the system?
Correct. Yeah, there are electronic sensors in the system that would indicate which direction the wind is coming. They actually have, you know, wind anemometers which measure the wind speed.
Right. So in the same way, say that a solar powered satellite knows how to turn towards the sun, these wind turbines know how to turn towards the wind.
Correct.
Okay. Now, what's the minimum amount of sustained wind needed at this point in time to make the installation of a wind turbine economic?
Okay. Well, the wind speed needs to be on the annual average. Let me just point out that the winds are never regular. They're at a given location, you're going to have some winds 1 minute and maybe no winds the next minute.
Right.
There's a continuous variation. But you can actually look at the probability distribution of the wind over a month or a year,
right?
And it looks pretty regular. You have relatively few hours of very low winds, then you'll peak up to some wind speed where you have the maximum number of hours, and then at very high wind speeds you'll have a few hours again.
Right. So it's kind of a bell-shaped curve.
It's almost a bell-shaped curve. It's called a Rayleigh distribution, usually, which it's bell-shaped on one side, and then it has a long tail on the high wind speed side.
Right.
Usually, it's pretty close to a bell-shaped curve. So if the mean wind speed of that curve is greater than about 7 meters per second, then the cost of the energy, the cost of the turbine compared to the energy output is low enough that you can generate wind at the same price as a new coal or new natural gas power plant. In other words, at 7 meters per second or faster, the direct cost of the wind is about 3 to 4 cents a kilowatt hour, which is the cost of energy from a new coal or new natural gas power plant.
Okay, and is this amortized over the life of the turbine?
Yeah, that's amortized over 20 years.
Okay.
Which turbines, I mean, that's their nominal lifetime, although in reality turbines that have been around since the 70s are still up, so they could last for much longer, in which case their costs would go down, but that's just based on the theoretical 20-year standard lifetime.
Okay, give us a human scale interpretation of 7 meters per second. You're walking. Is that comfortable? Is that blowing you over? Is that barely sensible, or what?
It's comfortable. It's not a.
It's a nice breeze.
Yeah, it's a nice breeze. It's equivalent to, I think, about 15 miles per hour.
Okay, about 15 miles an hour. And are you saying that at the 80-meter height where the new turbines go, that the wind tends to be more powerful than it is at the surface?
Right. So if you're near the surface, often you won't feel a very fast wind.
Right.
But the wind increases pretty gradually and sometimes rapidly with height as you go up.
Right.
And especially as you get away from the influence of trees and buildings and other kind of roughness elements, as they're called.
Right.
Things that slow down the wind. And you can check this by just watching a cloud.
Right.
And seeing how fast it moves. I mean, sometimes it doesn't look like it's moving very fast because it's far away.
Right.
But in fact, they're moving relatively fast.
Okay. So any place where there's scudding clouds, there's plenty of wind for...
Right. Or if you fly a kite, then you also see that how the wind is going to go as you get the kite up.
Okay, so with this meteorological and energetics background, let's talk about the recent papers that you've written about one of which is called Spatial and Temporal Distribution of U.S. Winds and Wind Power at 80 Meter Derived from Measurements. What are the major findings that you've derived from that study? And say a little bit about how you did it and what you found out.
Okay, well, this work was done primarily by a graduate student of mine, Christina Archer, and myself. And we looked at we tried to map the winds in the United States from data at 80 meters which for the first time, because there have been previous maps of winds at the U.S. And there was one map, for example, in the 1980s that looked at winds at 50 meters, but it didn't involve a lot of data, so much data.
How did they do it then without data? Is there some special meaning here for the term data?
They had some data. When I say data, well, we used a combination of what are called surface measurements, which are measurements around 10 meters from the ground.
Right.
And another type of data are sounding measurements, which are balloon launches that measure different atmospheric properties at different heights as you go up in the atmosphere. And these measurements can go up several kilometers, but we're really interested in measurements between 50 and 100 meters.
Who has most of this data? Does the National Oceanographic and Atmospheric Administration have a lot of this data, or private weather companies or television stations? What's the distribution of data about the weather and wind in the U.S.?
Well, we receive the data from the National Climatic Data Center and the Forecast Systems Laboratories, but most of the data were gathered from a variety of sources. Most of them publicly available. Most are public sources that the National Weather Service uses.
Okay, was this the first and largest study of its kind, would you say?
In terms of, the amount of data, and it was the first at 80 meters. Previous studies had looked mostly taken 10-meter measurements and used some extrapolations to get values at 50 meters.
Right.
Here we developed a new method where we can combine information from the vertical soundings, where we can interpolate, we can develop profiles of how the wind changes with height from
right.
the actual data, and then apply those to all the locations where we only have data at 10 meters.
Right.
And so we can generate a more accurate value at 80 meters where we don't have the data at 80 meters.
Okay, now you've already developed, as part of your general work, a comprehensive computer models for modeling the behavior of the atmosphere, haven't you?
Correct. Yeah, that's most of my work is actual numerical modeling.
And how did that help you figure this out? And how does figuring this out feed back into the models that you're building to understand the behavior of the atmosphere?
Well, in this particular case, we didn't use the computer models to generate any information
okay.
away from the data points. We just found values at the locations where we had data. In the U.S., there are around 1,000 or so locations where we can find, we had information. We also did a global wind mapping study more recently that we had about 8,000 locations worldwide.
Okay. Now, I want to ask a question that I'm a little skeptical of asking. It may sound silly, but does the harvesting of this energy from the wind by wind turbines have any reciprocal effect on the weather itself?
That's a good question, and the answer is it's not easy because it's not possible at this time to find out the exact feedback.
Right.
That is a goal of my research and a goal of some other people's research, which is to look at, well, what's the feedback of wind turbines back to the weather.
Right.
You can look anecdotally at some of the large wind farms and see that certainly, as the wind's going through a farm, the wind is slowed down.
Right.
The wind turbines are extracting energy from the wind.
Right.
Slowed down to some extent. But my feeling is that the total energy reduction at this point, especially with the current penetration of wind, is pretty small compared to, and it's on the order, it's much less than even the addition of buildings, for example, that also slow down the winds.
Right. So it's not likely to itself cause any noticeable climate change.
There'll be local changes.
Right.
In some cases, they're for the better.
Right.
For example, what happens is as wind hits a turbine, some of the energy is extracted, but then other energy goes upward.
Right.
And so the wind gets diverted upward. Now, if you're in a polluted region, that would mean some of the pollution would get sent upward and kind of, which is what you want in a polluted region, you kind of clean out that area.
And if you're in a local area famous for its too high winds, this would actually reduce it by a certain amount.
Yeah, if you don't like the wind to be so fast near where you are, that would slow it down, although it's usually the turbines aren't located right next to the houses.
Right. Okay. And I was trying to interest a California government official in this yesterday, in your research yesterday, and he mentioned, half jokingly, I think, that raptors are running into these turbines, and that's causing a problem. How much of a problem is that, anecdotally or statistically, from your observations?
Excuse the pun, but it's a red herring.
It's a red herring?
Because there's one location that raptors are an issue, and that's at Altamont Pass, California.
Right.
And because of that one location where raptors have been killed, that has kind of given... It's been stereotyped to be a problem for all wind farms.
Right.
That's really the only location worldwide where that's a particular problem. There are other locations where birds are killed, but in the U.S., on average, there are maybe about 10,000 birds per year killed.
Right.
And the reason that's a red herring is because that pales in comparison to the millions of birds killed by transmission lines and buildings
right.
in the U.S. So while certainly wind turbines do... kill birds, and you want to reduce that as much as possible. It's just really you don't hear anything about the buildings and transmission lines killing birds.
Their record, in other words, they're no worse than a transmission line or a building in terms of causing excess bird deaths.
Well,
what you're saying. There's nothing. They don't suck them in through their spinning or something.
Certainly if a bird goes through a turning blade, it's
right.
going to get chopped up, and maybe
right.
it's a different type of fatality than if it
right.
hits a building and
right.
gets knocked out.
Are there aversive stimuli, like sort of sonic scarecrows that could be set up on these to scare away the raptors? Are they pretty tough and they don't respond to that?
Well, a recent study for Altamont Pass suggested that the best method to solve the problem was to actually build larger turbines,
right.
taller turbines, because the pathways were generally about... I think, if I recall correctly, 50 to 60 meters
right.
above the ground. And building taller turbines would solve the problem. Now, the problem with Altamont Pass is there's a cap on the capacity. There's a cap on the total energy from wind that you can generate there
right.
from county rules, I believe it's county rules.
Right.
And that is a disincentive to build these taller turbines
right.
because it means you have to spend a lot of money to put in these new taller turbines, and that means that simultaneously you'd have to take out some older, shorter ones. Whereas ideally, so you're not really gaining any more energy,
right.
but you have to spend a lot of money to put in new turbines. However, if they had changed the law to allow more capacity at these places, then they could put in more turbines and actually get a lot more energy out of the place
right.
and hopefully address this problem. And the other thing is these new turbines, the new larger turbines, they move slower, and birds tend to flow around them, rather than the older turbines, these three-blade turbines that
right.
move much faster and tend to chop up the birds a little more.
Okay, and we can also assume, without knowing too much about bird psychology, some of these raptors are pretty smart. They're bound to figure it out after a while that they shouldn't go into these, I imagine.
Maybe you can't speak
for that. Okay.
But the other thing that's also a red herring on this is that when you're looking at wind turbines, you really have to look at what it's displacing.
If right.
it's displacing a coal or gas power plant that's putting out pollutants that are, in the United States, for example, 30,000 people a year die prematurely from pollution from coal-fired power plants.
Right.
So there really needs to be discussion of, what you're displacing.
Right.
At the same time as just looking at the raptor desk.
So you have to consider the whole system, not just part of it.
Yeah, I mean, the coal plants and the natural gas power plants, which are putting out oxides of nitrogen that produce ozone and particulates, I mean, they're also killing wildlife and birds in ways that you don't see so visibly, but they're doing it.
Okay. We've pretty much now got the micro picture taken care of. Let's talk about the macro picture in the sense of how many locations there are that provide a sufficient level of wind on a sufficiently steady basis to provide an economic basis for putting a lot more wind turbines in a lot more places.
Okay, well, we did mapping studies of the U.S. and also worldwide,
right.
and we found that in the United States, about 15% of the locations, the land area of the U.S., if we extrapolate the locations to all land area in the U.S.,
right.
about 15% of the land area has winds at 80 meters that are sufficiently fast for the cost of wind energy to be competitive with new coal or new natural gas power plants.
Okay, and with the, whatever the area of the U.S. is, this includes Alaska?
Yes.
Okay, so I'm sure you did the calculation. If it's 15% of the landmass, how much land is that, and how much of it is flat enough, or I don't know if it needs to be flat, but how much of it is typographically suitable for installing wind turbines?
Well, we didn't separate out the location. There was one of the caveats is that that doesn't separate out, you know, what are the feasible locations. But I should say that I'll tell you where the locations are.
And right.
Which in the greatest area of strong winds are in the Great Plains states, from all the way from North Dakota down to Texas, where the topography is pretty flat.
Or as Rodgers and Hammerson said, Oklahoma, where the wind comes rolling down the plains.
Exactly. Yeah. Okay. So in that area, it's all feasible. It's not a big deal. And that's actually where most of your wind is. Now, the other places where you have strong winds are in coastal areas.
Okay.
Along one of the places we found that wasn't known before was along the southern and southeastern coasts of the U.S.
Right.
Off the coast of Texas. You can go up to the coast, the northeastern coast, the Great Lakes, the state of Washington off the coast of California. Now, there's a little disadvantage off the coast of California in the sense that the water is deep. So the deeper the water, becomes more expensive to put wind turbines in.
Can wind turbines be floated, or do they have to be sunk?
Well,
into the bedrock, or
people have floated ideas of floating turbines, but there isn't a solid foundation, so to speak, for doing that. But so mostly what happens is you have a pole that gets sunk right into the ground. It's usually best if your water depth is less than 30 meters.
Right.
That's where it's feasible historically, especially in Europe, because they have a lot of offshore wind farms in Europe,
right,
off the coast of Europe, and northern Europe, that is. And off the coast of California, the water is generally deeper, except at the backsides of several islands, and you can find certain locations where you have shallower water. But that putting offshore is actually kind of the ideal place to put wind turbines otherwise, because the wind speeds are generally faster offshore,
right,
than they are onshore. They're very regular because every day you have this what's called a sea breeze.
Right.
And the sea breeze arises because of this differential heating between land and water.
Right.
During the day, the land always heats up relative to the water, so you generally get low pressure over the land relative to the higher pressure over the water. So you have air going from the high pressure over the water to the low pressure over the land. And that creates a breeze every day. And at about the same time, it peaks in the afternoon when the temperature difference is the greatest.
Right.
And so you have pretty regular winds and you have fast winds offshore coming onshore. And you're also close to population centers, usually near the coast.
Right.
So the transmission, which is another cost factor, is shorter distances.
Okay.
Reduce your cost.
Sounds like you've sold me on that. How well established is the engineering, the construction engineering for putting these? These would essentially then be in the water offshore.
Right. So, well, the engineering it's well established again for relatively shallow water, less than 30 meters, and there are farms existing that do this. And the people are working on technologies for doing it in deeper waters, and some ideas are floating turbines or connected. You could, just like oil derricks are installed offshore in deep water.
Right.
It's certainly possible.
It would be essentially possible to weight them somehow, right? They'd be floating, but they'd be weight. I don't know that much about about that.
The floating part you'd really need to stabilize it.
Right.
So I'm not sure how far along the floating idea is.
So it needs to be anchored in the seabed somehow.
Yeah, I mean, these things are pretty huge, so you'd really need to.
Right.
You really need to firmly secure them somehow.
So, and presumably there's been a lot of experience building offshore oil platforms.
Right.
That can be converted to understanding how to position these wind turbines.
Yeah, well, you could certainly do it just by having a long enough pole that just goes right to the
right.
Deep bed. I mean, that's one way to do it.
And then how does the electricity get sent back to shore?
Well, you just have a transmission line that's underwater that just goes towards the shore.
And again, that technology from undersea cable technology in general is well established as well.
Yeah, that's existing, and that's what they do in northern European offshore wind farms.
Okay, now, given what you've said about the Midwest and some of the the coastal areas, how many wind turbines would be necessary to generate? Pick a right figure, all the electrical needs of the United States?
Well, in practice, I mean, you'd maybe want to start, right? I mean, right now in the United States, wind satisfies less than 1% of the electric power output
right.
of the U.S. So a feasible upper limit, I think, would be 30 to 50% of the electric power from wind, at least until we have a learning curve that you can do even more.
On the order of what the French get from nuclear power.
Right. And the reason is because you want to vary your electric power sources.
Right.
Because wind is somewhat intermittent, it turns out that because it doesn't blow all the time exactly when you want it to blow,
right.
Then power operators are concerned, well, if you have too many wind turbines and nothing else, then let's say you have a really stagnant day, then it's really difficult to get energy.
It's the same worry about solar energy on a cloudy day.
Exactly. Now, there are two ways to mitigate that problem. One is that you can interconnect wind farms together on the transmission grid, because generally when the wind is not blowing in one place, it's blowing somewhere else.
Right.
So you can aggregate all the energy, and that will smooth out the total energy supply. But still, you can have some times when you don't have a lot of energy, even over a large area. So, which is why that maybe you'd have, let's say, 30 to 50% at the upper limit until we try that and see if how it, maybe we can try more. But with, let's say we're trying for 30 to 50%.
Right.
Then, let's say we're at 50, we want 50% of wind to for electricity. That would require about 375,000 or so turbines,
right.
1.5 megawatt turbines.
Essentially, how much land would have to be covered at the proper spacing of the turbines to achieve that level?
I believe that would take maybe about one-third the size of North Dakota or so.
Okay.
But keep in mind, that's for the whole United States.
Right.
And you'd certainly spread this out over a large area.
Right.
And you'd put as much out offshore as possible.
Right.
It's pretty much an infinite space offshore, except to find shallow water. That's
right.
The other challenge.
And in fact, having at least flown over that area, the Midwest, a few times, there's lots of open, empty space out there, it seems, isn't
well,
there?
Well, certainly in the Midwest, there's plenty of space, and farmers tend to like to lease their land for turbines because it's an additional energy source without... doesn't take up much space because it's just a pole in the ground.
Right. And would they typically lease it to a utility, or would they set it up themselves and sell the power, or how does that typically work?
Usually a utility will just lease the land for them, just pay them a royalty.
Right.
And the utility will install the turbine and own the turbine.
Okay. So you've then said that with about 350,000 of these, it would be possible to generate 30 to 50% of the electricity used in the United States. And presumably then, if we just wanted to do a hypothetical calculation, you've said about 750,000 would produce equivalent to the amount of electricity now being used.
Correct. Now, yeah, that's electric power.
Right.
Now, keep in mind, there's another use of wind energy that is beneficial, that would allow you to run your car.
Let's say something about that.
You can use the electricity from wind to generate hydrogen,
right,
in a process called electrolysis,
right,
where the electricity is just passed through water, and the water is then split into hydrogen and oxygen.
Now, where is this typically done in the process? At the wind turbine? At the central switching? At a central office? At homes or businesses? Where's the best place to turn the electricity into hydrogen?
You could do it at any place, but I think ideally you might have the contraption in which the electrolysis occurs called an electrolyzer, and usually the electrolyzer, it might be best to have it at a filling station,
right,
where you're then filling your car with hydrogen if you have a hydrogen fuel cell vehicle.
So essentially, you generate the electricity at the wind turbine, you send it through the grid to the station, and at the station, the electrolyzer converts it into hydrogen, which is then pumped into the vehicles.
Right, and that's one way to do it. Another way would be to generate the hydrogen right next to the wind turbine, but then you need pipelines
right.
to pipe the hydrogen, which are usually more expensive than transmission lines for transmitting electricity.
Okay, say something about what any version of this system would mean, both in terms of pollution, global warming, and energy dependency /independence.
Okay, well, the nice thing about generating hydrogen from wind electrolysis is that you can generate the hydrogen at any time. You just need to store it.
Right.
So it doesn't really matter when the wind is blowing so much, because the one thing you do know about wind is that over the year you're going to get a certain amount of wind energy. It's just you don't know exactly when during the year you're going to get it.
Right.
But it's pretty regular on a yearly average, or even on a monthly average, so you kind of know how much you're going to get over a year or a month.
And over the and amortized over the or integrated over the large a larger or larger area, it's even more predictable.
Yeah, so definitely, and over a larger area, it's predictable when you integrate the wind farms together. So you can get you'll get a certain amount of hydrogen that you'll know you'll get over the year, and that hydrogen will then you can use to replace gasoline,
right,
and to run your car with a hydrogen fuel cell vehicle. And so we did another study looking at, well, what's the effect of converting all the vehicles in the United States to hydrogen fuel cell vehicles?
Right.
What's the effect on air pollution, health, and climate?
This was your article called Cleaning the Air and Improving Health with Hydrogen Fuel Cell Vehicles.
Right. And so this this study, we looked at three different methods of producing hydrogen. One was wind electrolysis. The second was steam reforming of natural gas, which natural gas is made mostly of methane.
Right.
And
steam reforming means essentially burning the methane and using it to heat water to create steam. Using that to drive turbine blades to create electricity.
The steam reforming is you raise the temperature of water to a high enough temperature that it's vapor at a high temperature, and that vapor actually chemically reacts with the methane.
Oh, okay.
To produce hydrogen. So there is actually not a combustion process like in a natural gas power plant where you burn natural gas or methane to produce energy.
So you create superheated water, mix it with methane gas, and you get...
And then you get hydrogen and carbon dioxide as the two outputs.
Okay, so the output is to create, the purpose is to create the hydrogen.
Right. Now, so this method obviously produces carbon dioxide, which enhances global warming.
Right.
But it turns out that the amount of carbon dioxide produced is much less than the equivalent amount of carbon dioxide produced from burning gasoline in your internal combustion engine.
Right.
So the net process actually reduces CO2 emissions compared to gasoline engines.
Right.
But it still produces more CO2 and also methane, because methane leaks during the transmission of the methane to the steam reformer.
Okay.
So it actually is not quite so good as the wind case, because it produces some greenhouse gases, but it's still not so bad as your internal combustion engine. And then the third method was coal gasification, which is another chemical process where you raise the temperature of water and react it with coal, and that produces hydrogen plus some additional products.
So essentially there are three ways to make hydrogen, either through coal gasification, natural gas reforming,
right,
or the hydrolysis driven by the wind-generated electricity.
Right. And so we were looking at, well, if you did this and then you reduced the gasoline combustion emissions.
Right.
But you added the emissions from, for example, steam reforming of natural gas and coal gasification in place of it. And then in the case of wind electrolysis, there's certain additional emissions due to, for example, you need energy to compress the hydrogen.
Right.
And you know, certain energy outputs, unless you can use the energy from the wind itself to do that, but we didn't in this assumption.
Right.
So there are some small emissions there, too. But the net result is all three cases, you reduce the the main benefit is the reduction of the current fossil fuel vehicle emissions. And that, if you can reduce all the fossil fuel vehicle emissions, you can save, say, between 4,000 and 6,000 lives, premature deaths each year. And that is a, you know, say, that's in addition to millions of cases of asthma and cardiovascular disease and respiratory disease.
Right.
So there's a significant benefit just in any of these processes.
By converting to the hydrogen cycle.
Now, with the different methods of producing hydrogen, clearly wind gave you the best benefit in terms of both health and climate benefits and costs. And natural gas, the steam reforming process, was second. It resulted in not so good of a climate benefit, but it still had a good health benefit.
Right.
The coal gasification was an improvement over the current fossil fuel vehicle fleet, but resulted in greater health and climate costs relative to steam reforming or the wind. But there was one other option we looked at, which was converting all the vehicles to hybrid vehicles.
Right.
Now, which are hybrid gasoline-electric hybrid vehicles,
right.
There are some out there today. And in comparison with that, the coal case improved health compared with the hybrid vehicles. However, hybrid vehicles produce less global warming gases than the coal case. So now, it was kind of a wash.
Right. Now, fortunately, we've just, at Utopia Media, opened a new site called the Plug-in Hybrid Electric Vehicle World page.
Uh-huh.
And I don't know how familiar you are with it, but I'll send you the link to the site. You can get up to speed on it.
Okay.
There are people, especially in Monrovia, California, who are putting together plug-in hybrid electric vehicle systems built around the Prius.
Okay.
Hybrid, and they essentially add the capability. The EV1 system back in the 90s was electric only, and it had no gas engine, and it had to be charged in order to run, whereas the Prius runs on electricity when it can and on gasoline when it must. But it can't be externally charged. So by putting together those two systems, these people are creating plug-in hybrid electric vehicles that can be charged with electricity. And they do calculations on the order that you're doing to figure out who needs to drive where and when and so on. And they figure out that an awful lot of driving can be done within the range that they can charge these vehicles to with extra electricity. And they also point out, while I appreciate all of the calculations you've done about the benefits of a hydrogen-based vehicle fleet, they point out that it costs an awful lot to build one now, and a whole lot of infrastructure would have to be built to create that system, whereas there are already electric transmission lines and systems that could be used to charge their systems, which run off of household current, to create the an economy based around plug-in hybrid electric vehicles. So how does that correlate with your studies and suggestions?
Right. Well, there's certainly additional alternatives. We didn't look at all the possible configurations of vehicles, but there's the main issue in that case is where the electricity comes for the hybrid, the enhanced hybrid.
Right.
So essentially, in that case, what you have is you still have a gasoline electric hybrid. I mean, current gasoline electric hybrids, they don't require plug-ins. But what they're suggesting is to plug in the hybrid to store more energy in the battery, so more of it can. Of the time you can run on the battery.
They do a batteryectomy. They take out the installed battery and put in a much bigger, more powerful, heavier one.
Yeah, so the key is there, well, where's the electricity coming? If it's
right.
coming from your coal-fired power plant, then you're just trading emissions from one place.
Would it make sense to create a electric hydrogen a hybrid that would get its stored fuel from hydrogen and still have the advantages of the braking energy collection and extra electricity being pumped into the vehicle?
Yeah, that's a possibility. I mean, the other option is just have pure electric vehicles,
right.
where you generate the electricity from wind. Instead
right.
of taking the wind energy to generate the hydrogen, you can just generate the electricity directly from
right.
Use the electricity from the wind directly for the vehicle.
So there are essentially a lot of mix and match possibilities now opening
yeah.
up.
Oh, yeah, sure. Now, so the and there are certain efficiency advantages of different things. The key is the real key is you want to eliminate the combustion.
Right.
And so whatever you do, you want to eliminate the combustion at the coal-fired power plant or the natural gas power plant and replace it either, if you can generate the electricity from wind or solar, that's ideal. But that's the key thing, is how are you generating the electricity?
Right, you want to do it by a renewable source rather than by a combustible source.
Right.
And in fact, while we haven't talked about it much, solar photovoltaics could also complement and fit into this pattern as well, that some electricity can be generated by the photovoltaics, some by the wind, and it can either be electrolyzed into hydrogen or used directly as electricity.
Right. Now, solar photovoltaics are certainly, they're very clean. The only disadvantage compared to the wind is just they're much more expensive than wind energy at this point in time, mostly due to silicon shortages.
Okay.
So, talking about a factor of 2 to 4 times more expensive.
Solar photovoltaics 2 to 4 times more expensive than wind power?
Than wind power, yeah.
Okay. Talk a little bit about the economic climate and how the price of oil/gasoline impacts the economic viability of building more wind turbines.
I think the current climate affected gasoline prices are rising. I think that, gasoline is, oil is not used for generate electricity very much in the
right.
United States. However, it does affect the idea of whether you want to go to hydrogen. And when you talk about hydrogen, then wind becomes a possible player. So the higher prices of gasoline today are relevant with regard to wind energy.
So the point is that electricity can be converted into a combustible but low-polluting fuel in the form of hydrogen.
Right, and actually the cost of generating the hydrogen from wind is pretty low relative to the equivalent amount of gasoline you need. So one of the calculations we did was to look at what's the cost of generating hydrogen from wind and how does that cost then compare with the equivalent cost of gasoline to drive you the same distance.
Right.
And so the cost of gasoline is around now about $2.30 a gallon.
Right.
The cost of hydrogen, depending on whether your wind is generated at a fast wind site versus a slow wind site and how far your transmission is, it's, in the ideal case, the range is about $1 to $3 per equivalent gallon of gasoline.
Right.
And that's just the direct cost.
So the top range is $3 a gallon, you're saying?
Right. Now, there's the other thing, but the displaced, the hidden cost of gasoline is the health and climate cost, which
right.
was estimated at about 29 cents to $1.80 a gallon.
Right.
So if you take the cost of gasoline of $2.30 a gallon, you want to add about 29 cents to $1.80 a gallon to give you the health and climate cost, most of that is health cost,
right?
Due to enhanced mortality, work days lost, asthma, cardiovascular disease, respiratory disease, headache, other types of ailments. So if you look at the cost of the hydrogen from wind to gasoline, if you look at the real cost, then the real cost of the hydrogen, even with today's technology, is going to be less than the real cost of gasoline.
Okay, I want to talk about that in a minute, but also say something about ethanol or biodiesel and how they might filter into the mix here.
Ethanol is a biofuel, so it's made grown. It's converted from either wheat or some other type of agricultural product.
Corn.
Yeah, corn. And there are actually a variety of different types of grains they can develop ethanol from.
Right.
There was a recent study that looked at the energy required to produce the ethanol versus the energy the ethanol produced or
right.
generated.
Right.
And the study found that it takes more energy to produce ethanol than you get out of it.
So it's like trying to run a business where you lose money on every item, but you try to make it up in volume. It's not going to work.
Right. So there's, and that's the same with biodiesel.
Uh-huh.
The same study actually looked at biodiesel as well and found that it took more energy to produce in terms of irrigation, tractors, and fertilizers,
right,
and all sorts of, you know, other.
So if you want energy that uses more fuel than it creates energy, you don't have to just rely on fusion. You can do it this way. Present fusion, you can do it in biofuel. So you're essentially saying ethanol and biodiesel aren't really places to look.
No, I mean, because the only reason people are interested in biodiesel is they're thought that, well, maybe they're, you reduce the total CO2 emissions, carbon dioxide emissions into the atmosphere by using ethanol or biodiesel because they're essentially renewable.
Right.
But the fact is that they use a lot of energy to produce these fuels, and that energy, the energy comes from, ultimately, from combustion sources.
Right. And it's also somewhat like a shale oil that takes more energy to get it out than you're going to get when you're done.
Right. So there is no benefit in terms of climate, and certainly not air pollution, because when you're burning ethanol or biodiesel, you're putting out the same air pollutants as you are with gasoline, sometimes worse.
Right. Okay.
And, in fact, with certainly biodiesel, you have worse pollutants.
Okay. Yeah. Let me focus, as we're sort of wrapping up here, on the question of the real cost and the means by which people can come to understand what the real costs of these various fuel scenarios are, and how that might work its way into reality. What you've explained that if you factor in all of the costs associated with the use of one fuel or another, the alternatives that you're proposing with hydrogen from wind power are cheaper than gasoline.
Yeah, to society, right.
To society. But when people make a decision, sometimes it's based on how much it's going to cost them to fill their tank, rather
right.
than how much it's going to cost society. What thoughts do you have about how that distinction and the importance of the total cost, the total operating costs of using some of these different systems, different fuels, is? How that information can be communicated and understood and put into action.
The cost of hydrogen from wind, that was really the only one of the hydrogen scenarios where we really looked at the cost.
Right.
And if you just ignore the health benefits and the climate benefits, the direct cost, what I call them,
right,
of hydrogen from wind is $1 to $3 per equivalent gallon of gasoline.
And it's likely to stay there for the foreseeable future.
Well, because it's probably going to go down because wind prices costs will go down in the future as better technologies and bigger turbines and better placed turbines reduce.
But it's not going to go up, and it's not going to go up because of political instability in one place or another.
No, because wind energy is very regular, and it's a distributed energy source. So, and the United States has humongous wind resources compared to many countries in the world.
Right.
And there's no risk. The nice thing about wind energy is it's not a centralized energy source.
Right.
So there's no risk of terrorist attack like there is with a nuclear power plant.
Right.
Or even a coal power plant, which feeds a lot of houses and buildings.
So in fact, the energy is generated in a lot of little spots rather than one big one, and it would be just too much trouble for terrorists to go around blowing them all up.
No, it's virtually impossible. Especially if you have individual electrolyzers at individual fueling stations, which are all distributed.
Right.
So that essentially, there might be some central point where the transmission goes through in
right.
some locations, but there are multiple central points. So
this conversion really is an anti-terrorist measure, among other things, and as well as a national security enhancer.
I would say it's probably the greatest. Has the least risk of all the energy sources of being disrupted.
Okay. Focus, if you can, on how this message can be communicated to political decision makers, economic decision makers, and the general public.
Well, I mean, my goal is to try to do studies and to provide the information from the studies in a hopefully dispassionate way, and hopefully people will recognize the outputs and see the benefit and transmit the information to the people who make decisions. And certainly if I'm asked, I'll try to give the information to people who make decisions.
So you're ready to testify in front of the Senate Energy Committee on this whenever they call you?
Well, certainly if they're interested in In this information, I'm certainly happy to
okay,
get
good.
Some of the information.
All right, one last trick question here. Is there enough wind in the foothills behind Stanford to provide significant electric power for the campus, and is any thought being given to that?
I don't know if we have enough measurements locally to determine that quite yet. That's actually one of the goals, was to check the measurements there. Because we do have hills are... Some hills are good for fast winds, and other hills are not so good for fast winds.
Right.
Generally, from my experience here, the winds in this area, there's certainly a lot of roughness, so it's not we don't have the fastest winds.
Right.
But there are some places nearby. There's some hills nearby where I know the winds are fast. But I can't say without actually looking more detailed.
Okay, it would be a good advertisement for your theories and studies if you put up some turbines next to the dish and.
Right, they were thinking maybe one test turbine.
Though. And you could use it to run the dish, and it would essentially be organic means of listening for extraterrestrial life at the same time that you're not polluting the life we have here.
That's right.
I want to thank you very much for talking to us on Utopia Media Environment and Energy News Network, and I look forward to finding out more as your research goes ahead.
Okay, thank you very much, Mark.
Thank you.
Okay.
Bye.
Bye-bye.
Okay.